Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that 8-show a week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is an effect built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Jo Litson has been one of the nation's treasured arts journalists for some 37 years. She is the print editor of Limelight, the magazine that celebrates music, arts and culture. Jo originally joined Limelight magazine as deputy editor in August 2016, after more than 25 years working as a freelance arts writer for publications that included The Australian, Limelight magazine, The Bulletin, The Qantas magazine, POL Oxygen, the Sydney Theatre Company's Backstage magazine, and The Sunday Telegraph, where she had been the arts writer, theatre reviewer since 2006. Her appreciation of all arts is extensive, informed by a lifetime working in and around stages. How fortunate we are to have Jo celebrating performance, investigating craft, and shining the light. Jo Litson, hello and welcome to Stages.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a delight to be able to talk to you, because I've been a fan of your writing for many years.
Well, thank you.
In the various platforms that you've written for, and now editor at large at Limelight magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're very proud of Limelight, that sort of little niche publication, but still going strong, which is great.
Well, I love it. It's available digitally, but also having a copy in your hand, which arrives every month, reminds me of growing up when, before the internet, when you would have to subscribe to the Sondheim Review or Plays and Players, or just to get all of your arts information.
Yeah. Exactly. I think we've got two audiences now, really. The audience that is like that, probably an older audience and loves having the physical magazine and have subscribed for years. But then we're building the digital, and that's a younger audience that just dip in and out of news, reviews, whatever.
Well, it's a national magazine too, also, isn't it?
It is.
To keep us all informed about what's happening in every state.
It is, absolutely.
Yeah, it's great. Now, you've just come back from London.
We have.
Yeah, how exciting. What did you see?
Well, we only saw two shows this time, because it wasn't one of those holidays that you just go and try and do a show a day, which I have done and love doing. But this was more to go and see our younger son who lives there, right, and some family. But we saw two shows, Sunset Boulevard with Nicole Scherzinger, and then the Guys and Dolls at the Bridge Theatre, Nicholas Heitner.
Both shows getting a lot of attention. A lot of people,
yeah,
saying that they love them, because it's such radical reinterpretations of classic musicals.
Exactly. I mean, we booked the Sunset Boulevard before it had opened and before the reviews came out, but we were just fascinated. And it's a show that's sort of very close to my family's heart, actually, because my husband, Sal, was in the original Australian production of Sunset. So obviously knows it inside out. I saw it many times. Our elder son, Tom, was only 8, but loved it and came along and was allowed to go and see the odd rehearsal. So we loved it, and we were just fascinated to see what Jamie Lloyd was going to do with it. And look, I know not everybody's loved it, but we were absolutely blown away by it. I mean, it's beautiful, it's dark, it's just black and white. You know, they use a lot of projections really cleverly, sort of handheld cameras at times. So it just looks gorgeous, but you really realise watching that show how tough Hollywood is. It brings all that kind of
that
stuff
grit
through. Yeah. Mm. And she is extraordinary. She's just so fierce. You just sense her anger and her frustration, but her absolute belief in who she is. So, like, with one look. I mean, the audience just went berserk. Yeah. But, gosh, she sang it amazing and acted it. It was, it was extraordinary. And all she wears is a black sort of little negligee. They don't change colour. It's nothing like the original production with the extraordinary set and
big
Anthony
hats,
Powell's got
costumes,
all that.
Yeah.
So it's very slick. We thought it a little bit like Chicago, that production where they honed it all back and it's very sleek and dark, and then the focus is really on the actors and the music. And it's like that. And the music was phenomenal. And the boy playing Joe, Tom Francis, I thought he was wonderful too. So we just loved it.
Well, it's all about the text, isn't it? Being honouring the text.
Yeah,
Because the aesthetic can sometimes get in the way, kind of.
Yeah. Really paired it back to the emotion. Like the emotions just really surged.
And so refreshing. Also, I mean, we get used to those franchise musicals, for want of a better term, where the production of Phantom that you see on Broadway is the same in London and it's the same in Australia. And we, those of us who saw Sunset, which is now 20 years ago, isn't it?
25 years ago or something.
To see a radical reinterpretation is quite exciting, and it's going to hit or miss.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And it was interesting that Lloyd Webber was obviously gave the go-ahead. I feel he must have been thrilled, because I think the music just really comes into its own. I mean, I like the musical anyway. But, I mean, so fascinating that we're going to have a new production here. But it's obviously going to be very different to that, probably more traditional. But then you've got Sarah Brightman, very different, you know, soprano,
casting.
Very different singer again. So it's going to be interesting to see how that is too.
And wonderful that Lloyd Webber has relinquished those original productions. Phantom of the Opera recently, we saw a new production at the Opera House. And, of course, that wonderful production
on the Harbour.
On the Harbour.
Yeah. No, I mean, it must be exciting for him, I think, you know, to have directors like Jamie Lloyd, Ivo van Hove wanting to come and stage the work in such a new way. Yeah. So I think it makes us look at the musicals afresh. So I feel he's probably quite excited that, you know, he's getting this whole new renaissance in a way.
Yeah, and a new generation of audience.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So Guys and Dolls, it's an immersive experience.
Yes.
So you get to strut Broadway with all those Damon Runyon
characters.
We didn't
immerse, I have to admit. But yeah, absolutely. It's sort of done in the round. I'd never been to the Bridge Theatre before.
No, it's quite a new theatre, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. And then, as you probably know, there are all these different stages which rise and fall in different formations. And then you can have some of the audience you can pay to be on the floor, so you move around with it and you stand around the stages. We sat in the front row, so we were very, very close.
Yeah.
But I've got friends who did the immersive thing and loved it. I mean, it's very cleverly done, and they've also got a lot of crew just very carefully moving the audience out the way as the stage is about to rise. But I've got friends who said, no, they didn't find that distracting. They just loved following it around.
So did they become audiences at the Hot Box or at the crapshoot?
Sort of. There's sort of a little bit like Cops at one point. And I suppose they are close to the Hot Box. And at interval, they get the singers coming out performing as if they were at the Hot Box, which was fun. But yeah, it's just a different way of bringing the audience in to engage with the show. So I was glad I saw it, because Sal was in that productions, well, the original Australian production of that, and that was where we met, because I was a dresser on that show. So again, two shows very much sort of close to our family. So it was just so lovely to see two very different productions of them.
Yeah. A dresser?
Yeah, I was a dresser only for like two shows.
But looking at your CV, you've had many disparate experiences
yes,
in the theatre, which is wonderful. And I think essential to inform you about other parts of the theatre and what you do today.
Yeah.
Tell me about being a dresser. Because I think you first did that in London, didn't you?
No, I did do that here. I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Naira show, The Golden Age. And that was the first time I'd worked backstage, and I loved it. I mean, I got into working theatre just because I wanted to be involved in theatre, not because I wanted to be a journalist. I've always wanted to be involved in theatre in some way. So having worked as an ASM, a close friend of mine worked in the wardrobe and told me they were looking for some dresses on La Cage aux Folles in Melbourne. So I did that and I absolutely loved it. I looked after all the boys, that Todd McKenney in one of his early shows.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I did Guys and Dolls, and that's how I met Sal, actually. And I did do a bit of dressing up in Sydney, but just as a freelancer, but not for a huge amount of time. But no, I agree with you. I think if you end up becoming a journalist, it's so good to have worked in the theatre and know how it all works, having seen it from backstage.
And well, that backstage show is often, sometimes, can be more exciting than what's happening on stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And some of the quick changes. I mean, La Cage aux Folles had some extraordinarily quick changes that had to be so carefully calibrated so they could get on and off into the can-can in like 10 seconds or something. But, I mean, I did love all that because, as I say, I just loved the theatre and I just wanted to be involved with it.
So you grew up in the UK.
Yeah.
What were your artistic influences growing up? Did the family take you off to the theatre?
Not so much, because I grew up in Dorset, in a town, well, Dorchester, then Swanage, and back to Dorchester, and there wasn't really a theatre there. Like, we had a Corn Exchange in Dorchester, and so occasionally there'd be a touring show. But no, I mean, the big treat when I was young was my parents taking me and my two brothers to Bournemouth to see the latest Disney movie. But we didn't, apart from pantomimes, no, not really. But in high school, we did a production of The Importance of Being Earnest, and I was Miss Prism. And it was like, you know, enlightenment. I was so nervous each day. I would be almost physically sick going on. But once I got on stage, I didn't want to leave it. Yeah. And so I had been planning to apply just to study English at university. But I just loved doing this so much. I did a combined honours degree in English and drama. I changed my choice. So I went to Birmingham University, where they had a fantastic course. And I mean, I loved doing every aspect of it, but I did realise there that I was never going to be a performer. I really was not good enough. I mean, I was in The Tempest and a few productions. We did Company there, but I wasn't in it. I ran the front of house. And I thought, no, this is, I'm better doing that than trying to be on stage. But I mean, again, I just loved studying every aspect of it.
So a tertiary study, is that the first time that you're seeing professional theatre?
It was really access, yes, yes. So we saw a lot in Birmingham. There was a lot on.
It was touring.
And in the, you know, the Birmingham Rep and companies there, we'd go to London and see shows because suddenly I was surrounded by people who'd been to theatre all their lives. I mean, most of the drama students, a lot of them were from London. They knew so much about theatre, so that was a real eye opener for me. So we also, which was really important in my career, we had a wonderful tutor who was obsessed with Sondheim. And so we did a production of Company. Again, I wasn't in it. But he sort of opened my eyes to Sondheim. I mean, at that point, that was sort of the late 70s, that was at university. So he'd already written Follies, Company, whatever. But Into the Woods was still to come. And so I absolutely fell in love with Sondheim. And musicals, and that really did come out of what I learned at university, I think.
Yeah. He was the Shakespeare of musicals, wasn't he? And the way that he reinvented form
amazing.
And
the lyrics are just so, so clever, but also so human.
Well, I found also growing up, you know, that exciting time, a new Sondheim show had come out on LP, so you'd go down to the record shop and buy Avery and Susan's, put it on the turntable and just listen to that and imagine that story. It was so exciting.
Yes, I mean, I remember buying a cassette tape of Assassins, and, you know, when they had the Into the Woods and they recorded the Broadway production, and we recorded it, and my elder son, when he was very young, like 4 or 5, watched it, I mean, 1,000 times. We just knew it so well. He was invited to the opening night of Sydney Theatre Company's production because people just got to know that he loved it so much, as did numerous people. You talked to so many musical theatre performers who just watched that show endlessly on the video of the show. Yeah. But yeah, so that was really important. I absolutely fell in love with musicals. And then when I left university, I moved to London. And I literally just walked around the West End, going into every theatre saying, have you got a job? And got a job at the Duke of York's Theatre in the box office. And then all the box office networks knew each other. So particularly previews and things, they'd give you tickets. So I just started going to the theatre all the time.
What were some of the shows that you recall from that time?
Well, one of the ones
original productions, I guess.
Yes, one of the ones I really, really recall was the original Sweeney Todd at Drury Lane.
With Dennis Quilly.
Dennis Quilly and Sheila Hancock. Hmm. That was so exhilarating, seeing that. But, I mean, Evita was opening. I remember taking my mum to Cats. I mean, all these kinds of shows were on at the time. So it was really... Yeah, that was so exciting. And, I mean, when I was paying, I'd be sitting in the gods. You know, you'd see these tiny figures on the stage. But just to be there and to be soaking it all up, yeah. Just fantastic.
British Actors Equity, you worked there for?
Yes, I did. One of my biggest regrets, and it's such a silly thing, is when I was in the box office, they advertised for an office junior at the Prince Edward Theatre where Evita was running, and I applied for that, and I got it. And then my parents did that thing of, but you're a graduate, and shouldn't you be getting a proper job and earning a bit more money? And stupidly, I listened. So I went and worked at a graphic design studio for a while, and I really didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
So I was looking for jobs, and British Actors Equity advertised for two assistant organisers in their theatre department. So I went and worked there. But then at the same time, I was working front of house at night. So I worked at the Mermaid Theatre for a while, just as an usher, and then at the Phoenix Theatre. So just to be in a theatre as well, to be part of it as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, Equity was fantastic because, again, you're seeing that side, the contractual side of things, looking at the challenges the actors had. And, I mean, things that stand out so much for me, that was when Cameron McIntosh was really starting out. And he was so respected by people at Limelight because he really honoured the contract and would really negotiate with the people at Equity. He was always really...
Well, he wanted to do things...
But do the right
correctly.
Thing.
Yeah. Of course, he came from being a stage manager, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. Hmm. He did. So that was fabulous. And I really enjoyed working there. But from there, I came out to Australia. And again, I just sort of wanted to get back into theatre. So I literally did the same thing of walking around theatres again and got a job at the Playbox Theatre. Because I was in Melbourne for 4 years before I came to Sydney.
What brought you to Australia?
Well, I was living with an Australian man.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
That'd do it.
That did it, yeah.
And then a series of jobs, including Half Ticks. In Melbourne.
That was in Sydney because I spent 4 years in Melbourne at Playbox and, again, was doing some of the front of house. I ran the box office at Her Majesty's Theatre for a while, and like Reggie Livermore's firing squad was there. And then I dressed Lacage and Guys and Dolls in Melbourne, and then I moved up to Sydney because I'd visited Sydney a few times and I just felt really at home here.
Mm.
So I moved here. And then it's always that thing, you move to a new city, you're just trying to find work, really, aren't you? So, again, I always just did that, I just wrote to everybody. And I remember meeting Harry M. Miller, and he had an office right next to the Australian Elizabethan Theatre Trust at that time, and they were about to open Half Ticks in Martin Place. So I was just there at the right time, actually. They were looking for somebody. And I'd actually done a lot of box office over the years. So I got that job.
Did that ever take off, that Half Ticks system? Because, you know, in America, you've got the TDF booth.
That's right.
And in London, there's...
Leicester Square, they've still got it. Yeah.
But Australia... I suppose we just didn't have the amount of product. That,
probably. Yeah. Because it didn't really survive that long, did it?
No.
I don't know in the end exactly why it closed, but clearly, as you say, it isn't an ongoing thing. And I suppose maybe with the move to online, there are all kinds of online options now, aren't there, for that?
Yeah, absolutely. And online lotteries and
exactly.
all sorts of ways to get your tickets.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the move into actually being arts journalist, covering what was happening, how did that all happen?
Well, that was a fluke, really, because when I moved to Sydney, there was a magazine, I can't remember what it was called, but I think it was something like Performing Arts News. Neil Churches ran it. Right. And they'd commissioned a story about the Playbox Theatre as a cover story. And I don't know the real ins and outs of it, but they weren't able to use the story. And because I'd worked with them as a publicist at Playbox, they said, look, we're a bit desperate, can you write us a story? That's literally how it happened. And I sort of looked at this magazine and my story in there. I thought, oh, and I really enjoyed doing it, and it was quite a buzz. So I thought maybe I'd like to do more of this. And again, coincidentally, at the same time, I was sharing a flat in Sydney, and two of the people in the flat were journalists at The Australian. They weren't arts journalists, but they worked there. And so one of them organised for me to go and meet Maria Parar, who was the arts editor. And she was fantastic. Like, she was really supportive and used me as a freelancer and then several arts editors, including Deborah Jones after that. So I wrote for The Australian for a long time. And at one point, actually, Maria Parar did try and get me on board as her deputy. But you see, I hadn't done a cadetship. I hadn't gone through that system. So the paper wouldn't agree to it. But even so, look, I was so lucky to just do so much as a freelancer.
So what period is this? What decade?
So 80s. I got to Sydney in 86.
Right.
And that's when I started freelancing. So I would have been freelancing for The Australian 86, 87. I mean, it happened relatively quickly.
Yeah.
So I was freelanced right through into the, well, 2010s, I suppose. I freelanced for numerous publications.
Well, the 80s period was a time when there was quite a broad arts coverage across print media.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
even you talk about Into the Woods on ABC on Sunday afternoon used to have an arts program.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
how we saw Into
that's
the Woods
right.
or Sweeney Todd or Follies in Concert. I remember all those Sondheim specials that they would play. We even had a minister for the arts at that time.
I know. You're right. And there were so many options as a freelancer. And then, you know, things began to get tighter and staff reduced, particularly in the arts departments. Suddenly there weren't deputy editors anymore, and they were using their own in-house writers. And it just started to get, for me anyway, harder and harder. And I think there was even one point where I thought, I wonder if I'm going to have enough work to keep going.
Yeah.
And then I got a job at the Sunday Telegraph, which was so different to having been at The Australian, because they're very short pieces. But that was fantastic because it kept me... I was writing a theatre story and a theatre review a week. I did that for 12 years.
Wow.
So that kept me going to the theatre. And, you know, I had to learn very quickly how to write very short and sharp, which is not something I'd been doing at The Australian, really, writing big features for review and whatever. And then also while I was doing that, then I was appointed at Limelight. I mean, I'd freelanced for Limelight for decades, but Clive Padgett was the editor and they were looking for a deputy, and he sort of said to me, why don't you apply? And I said, well, I just don't know enough about classical music, really. And he said, well, look, we're actually looking to expand it. We want to include more theatre. And, I mean, he's so knowledgeable about classical music, but also opera and musicals as well. But they had a lot of very knowledgeable writers covering classical music. So I came in to sort of try and bring a bit more theatre into it. And I loved opera anyway. I'd been going to opera for years and years and years. But then I hadn't been there very long when Clive and his partner moved to New York. So I was only deputy for a few 6 months or something, and then I became editor, which is like, oh my goodness, mate, can I do this? But yeah, no, I've loved it. I've loved doing it.
Yeah. The magazine now has quite a very much cross-section of disciplines that you cover.
We really have developed that.
Yeah.
Very much, because when I mean, as you know, the history of the magazine, and when it started, it was with the ABC. It was very, very classically music-focused, and that still would be, you know, a central tentpole of what we cover. But the magazine was redesigned during COVID because we had new publishers then, and we really did try and... Well, I certainly really did try and expand our coverage of musicals because there's such a dedicated audience for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, we pick and choose still what we feel is going to interest Limelight readers. And a lot more theatre, more dance. I mean, still contemporary dance is not so big among our readership, but they love the ballet.
Mm.
So we really have expanded that. And, I mean, over the years, as you know, things have changed so much and the whole digital thing has expanded. So we had a restructure this year. So we've now got a digital editor,
right.
Jason Blake. So yep. Instead of having the deputy editor, so he drives all the digital. And then I focus on the magazine. And I think that's been a really good restructure because they're both sort of demanding, and the digital is, you know, it's expanding rapidly and changing, and you've got so many different things happening. Reviews changing, AI on the horizon. So it's good to have somebody who's really focused on that and tuned into that and driving that.
Yeah.
Whereas I focus probably on the more sort of traditional sort of print stories that we cover in Limelight. So I do feel that's been a good move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jo, let's talk about Theatre Review. The great London critic Michael Billington said that key to any critic is to be honest to your reactions.
Mm.
Is it tough writing a review sometimes when you haven't particularly enjoyed something as much as you hoped?
I think it's really tough, and I think a lot of reviewers don't do it, and particularly Australia, because it's a very small market.
Mm.
So I think people are sometimes really scared to lash out. But yeah, no, it is tricky, particularly if you feel something that nobody else seems to feel. You've just got to be brave and say, because that's all you can do, isn't it? I mean, somebody told me early on as a reviewer exactly that. You absolutely have to be true to yourself. And the other thing is you have to believe in yourself as well. You have to believe that you are qualified enough to be doing
yes,
it so that
yeah.
what you say does have some integrity, and you've
yeah.
got to stand by what you feel.
Yeah.
But there's ways of saying things as well without being cruel. And I think it takes you a bit of time to find the right tone
yeah.
that's right for you, and to say things without being unnecessarily unkind.
Well, we all know those critics internationally too. People be like, remember John Simon from The New Yorker,
yes.
I think, who
yeah.
was more about
yes.
his barbs than actually
yes.
the
Yes, I mean, Clive
appraisal.
Barnes, wasn't he the
yeah,
butcher of Broadway?
Yeah.
Or, but yeah.
yeah.
yeah. I mean, the New York Times, you looked at, they have so much space.
Yeah.
So if they're going to be negative about something, you can really argue your case in
yes.
some kind of depth. But often, particularly these days, you're not. You've got a limited number of words. And then you've got the star rating, which I think has changed things as
yeah.
well. I don't know, personally, and I know a lot of reviewers are not that keen on star ratings. And the Australian actually still don't use them. But it does seem to be the way of the world. And I think we sometimes feel that if it's like 3 stars, but maybe do people read it in depth, or do they just look at the star rating?
Yeah.
I feel like sometimes that happens.
Mm.
But, look, it's a changing world, isn't it? Again, because of... you know, the whole internet, the whole
yes.
digital world has just changed it, and the mainstream media has been cutting back on its reviews. You don't see anywhere near the number of reviews as you used to see.
No, unless you go online, a lot of those reviewers have their own blog now, and
that's right.
where you
yeah.
can access. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, in the mainstream media, I mean, the Herald still runs reviews, of course, but sometimes it's like 2 in a short review. But then the whole online thing is just huge, and until you get to know the writers and know whether you trust them, they're just so many people. I mean, do any of them have the expertise or the background? A lot of them you just don't know whether they do. Or so you, I suppose you have to read and get to know the people that you think are worth following.
Yeah, absolutely. You work that out. I mean, Billington, you know, had been doing it for decades.
He was one of the people I loved reading Michael Billington's reviews. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and he would have seen things change massively over the years.
I mean, and that sense of responsibility, because you are assessing a product where directors, writers, actors have invested months, sometimes years of their work time creating.
Catherine Brisbane was always wonderful about that, because she always used to say that you need to remember that when you're a reviewer. You need to remember that they had a real reason for doing this, and they all came together and have put so much into it. But by the same token, you can't then say everything's wonderful just because people have given time and effort and love and energy. Sometimes things really don't work, and you have to be honest, because otherwise readers in the end don't trust you.
Yeah.
If you just say everything's wonderful, people aren't going to believe you anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what you feel about this, but I don't think reviews, open close shows like they used to, I don't think they have the same impact as they used to anymore.
Not even in New York, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's changed so much. And I mean, another interesting thing is you look at ticket outlets like Ticketek, for example, and they have readers putting in their little reviews. And I think a lot of people read those too.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone has a chance to be a reviewer now.
Yes, well, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's the GP, probably more than people in the business or people who just love it and are knowledgeable and read extensively about it. But I mean, they obviously play a real role. And word of mouth still does, doesn't it? Yeah, so much.
Very much so.
Really does, yeah.
So you're recording your reaction. Tell me about the time frame. You attend an opening night, and then you head straight home and jot down everything you...
I was
fascinated that you can remember detail about what you saw.
Yes, some people do. I mean, I know a few of the reviewers writing now. Some of them will go home and write immediately, you know, in the white heat. They'll sit down and write. I'm just not one of those people. I'm not a night owl. I'm much better early in the morning. Like, if I have to file really early, I'd rather get up at 4 in the morning than sit up late.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's good, because when you're doing a review, honestly, your brain is whirring all night, all through your sleep. If you might go to bed thinking, I've got no idea how to start this review. You sort of know what you think. How am I going to start this one to say? And all night, I think your brain is just sifting it. So I prefer to wake up in the morning and then sit down and do it.
Let it stew, digest it.
Yeah. But it's, look, it's sort of interesting the way it's flipped, because you remember in the old days, you know, the critics used to sit on the aisle and they'd run out and they used to literally have to go home, write the review, file it in an hour or whatever. Mm-hmm. And people would sit in restaurants and wait to read it. Yeah. And then that disappeared. But now with social media, I think, you know, you're pretty well, you should be filing the next day. You really should. People want to know. So you probably need to get up and write straight away.
There's a lot to inform yourself about also, I imagine, if it's an original work that you're seeing, or it's a revival. I mean, you want to become familiar with original productions and playwrights and personnel involved.
Yes, absolutely. You need to have done your homework before
you go.
Know
what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the publicists really understand, particularly with a brand new musical, they really understand that. So they will sometimes let you go to previews as well. You wouldn't review the preview, of course, but they would let you go so that you can see it two or three times before you then sit down and write. And I think sometimes with a big new musical in particular...
Yeah.
I think that's really valuable
to
do that. But absolutely, I mean, if it's a new production of a classic play, you need to know the play, don't you? And then go in and assess how they've changed it, why they've changed it, what's worked, what hasn't. So, you know, the best reviewers are probably people who are freelancers because they've got a lot of time to really prepare. Whereas when you're working full time, you're scrambling to get that done. So I guess a lot of it is the knowledge you've built up over the years.
Are there plays or musicals where you think, oh, not another Midsummer Night's Dream?
I suppose that there are.
But then you can be pleasantly surprised, yeah. I guess, by the new life which is breathing
yeah.
into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I suppose we all think that about certain things, but you can never go and not be surprised. There is always that lovely moment when you're sitting there, you're waiting for the curtain to go up, and that excitement, like, is this going to be wonderful? And sometimes it just blows you out of the water, and you see things different. You see, I think the Hayes Theatre has been wonderful at doing that.
Yeah.
By having that really small venue and wonderful directors like Dean Bryant who come in and just blow the dust off things, and you seeing shows in ways you haven't seen before. And Alexander Ballage, you know, he's done some wonderful things, shows that overseas have not been really successful.
Well, American Psycho. I saw it on Broadway,
which
I enjoyed. But here I thought, wow, I said, Ballage just nailed it.
Yeah.
And that extraordinary cast.
Yeah, such a fabulous production.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely, I love all that. I mean, there'll be shows that have been done a million times and they bring absolutely nothing new to it at all, but you just never can know, and you just have to always go and hope, really, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You talk about Sondheim being your favourite musical creator. What about plays? Who's your favourite dramatist or the playwrights?
That's a hard one. I mean, I've loved seeing works by people like Robert Lepage. You know, there's big, immersive, extraordinary things. I mean, I love Shakespeare. You can just go endlessly. So many wonderful playwrights like David Hare, Tom Stoppard. I mean, you know, growing up in England, I think I've got a real affinity for a lot of the English playwrights. I mean, I was absolutely adored Noel Coward.
Oh, yeah.
Great. I love Noel Coward. I think he's very hard to stage well.
Yeah.
But I absolutely adore his playing.
Well, it gets back to the creatives and the actors understanding style.
Yeah.
Isn't it? We're all seeing those productions with big casts of 15 and there's four different plays being done.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, it's hard. I'm trying to think now who are my favourite writers. But
well, then these Americans, of course, Tennessee Williams. And
oh, I know. And I mean, seeing a play like August, Osage County, I mean, I'm so looking forward to seeing that again. That's just such an extraordinary piece.
Yeah. And weren't we lucky also with Sydney Theatre Company bringing that Steppenwolf Company out to do it in Australia before they went to Broadway?
Yes, exactly.
And the same with the History Boys that the National brought out.
Yeah, and Angels in America. I mean, Michael Gow did the first part of Angels in America at STC just like the following year. And again, what an extraordinary play that is.
I saw that at Russell Street at Melbourne Theatre Company, which Neil Armfielder had directed.
I've seen quite a few productions of that. I saw it at Belvoir, but I saw it at the National one. Declan Donnellan did it there. And I mean, the TV, the sort of, was it TV that they did it?
Yes. Mike Nichols directed.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So that's another fantastic piece. And I mean, some of the things you remember are just those big immersive things, like Nicholas Nickleby, for example.
Nicholas Nickleby has its 40th anniversary on the 10th of December this year.
Oh, goodness me.
Yeah, since it opened at the Theatre Royal in Sydney. But yes, yeah, so those big epics. And Cloud Street on a local.
Cloud Street was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something really special, I think, about one of those big, huge events that really takes you on its journey. You know, like the War of the Roses or Barry Kosky's Lost Echo. Just fantastic.
Yeah.
They're often the kinds of things that you remember forever, I think.
Yeah. Tell me about the Archibald.
The Archibald, yes, I've been doing that for decades. Yeah. Now, that's fantastic. That happened, must be at least 25 years ago. One of the people working at the gallery in the media department asked me if I'd come in, and it was before emails even really, would I come in and interview each of the artists who had a painting in the Archibald Prize, the finalists, and write a little bit about it. So I've been doing it ever since.
Every year? Do you interview every artist?
Yes, but things have changed now, of course. You do it all by email now.
Right.
But I used to literally have to pick up the phone and interview them. I'm glad we don't do that because the time frame is very tight. Yeah. They've extended the time frame over the years. The first few years I did it, I had like 3 or 4 days. Mind you, now there's a lot more artists in the finals, but it's always, you'd have to do it quite quickly, but it's fascinating. And I do it all by email. A lot of the painters have been in many times over the years, so I've got to know them. And I mean, I haven't done every single year, but I've probably done them all apart from 2, maybe 3 that I haven't done for various reasons, but I've done every other, and I'll do them again next year. Yeah. And I've really enjoyed doing that. Very grateful to the gallery for giving me that.
It's vital, isn't it, that we document our arts heritage, our culture.
Yes, and I think the reason they brought a writer like me in to do that, rather than their curators, they do a lot of, you know, that they're labelling themselves, of course. But I think they looked at that exhibition. It gets such a wide general audience and a lot of people that go to that every year but don't really go to any other exhibition. So they wanted it to have a bit of a featurey feel.
Yeah.
To just explain to people sort of, you know, fairly quickly, but who the subject is, why the artist painted them, little things to look out for in the painting about what they did. And you find, you know, I go and look and people do gather around those labels, so that I think they really enjoy that. It gives them a little bit more of an insight into the portrait.
Yeah. Informed.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Jo, why do you think arts are so important to a community, to society?
They just tell us about ourselves, don't they?
They hold a mirror up.
They do hold a mirror up. And they, you know, they look at what's happening around us socially, politically. They entertain us when we're really down and we just need a good laugh. But I just think that artists have got such a wonderful way of looking at the world, and they see the world differently, and they then share that with us. And I think audiences, we just learn so much. You just wish more people would come. So often we come out and say, that was absolutely amazing. I just wish every politician in the country would go and see it. You know, you feel that sometimes, that we're preaching to the converted, maybe. But I just think they're absolutely crucial for any culture to look at itself, see what's happening, and help us move forward, face the things we're doing wrong, join together and move into future better. They show us heart and soul. It sounds such a cliche, but they do, don't they?
They do, absolutely.
Yeah.
All those statistics that came out during the COVID period as well about the number of people who were audiences in a year for the arts certainly equates, if not eclipses, sporting audiences.
Yes, that's right.
And yet in the media, the attention to the arts compared to sport just doesn't compare.
It's been ever thus, isn't it? And I remember so often a sort of fighting and saying, why can't you have one small art story on the news each night? You have so much sport. Yeah. Just one little art story would just help spread the word, introduce people, so that, you know, some people maybe feel a bit daunted about going to Melbourne Arts Centre or the Opera House. Mm. You know, you hear people still saying that they'd gone to a show there and they'd never been except inside the venue. I just think if we made it just there on the news every night, says that it's commonplace.
Yes.
And as you say, when you look at exhibitions, musicals and plays, and things, so many people go.
Yeah.
And yet, I don't know, why? Is it the clicks that the newspapers get that more people read sport? I don't know, it's just always been disappointing that the arts don't get more coverage. And then when they do art shows, good shows, but they're like on a Sunday afternoon. They just need to be there all the time.
Yeah, yeah. In prime time.
Yeah, in prime time.
People can watch it.
Yeah.
But also it's the financial support of the arts as well, isn't it? You know, you look at Europe and America, yeah, and you've got all those patrons of and benefactors for the arts, and that's something that we don't have as a culture here at all.
No.
Really. Considering there are quite a few billionaires in the country.
Yes, and that's right.
You can throw some money arts way.
Exactly, and you hear people like Barry Kosky being so articulate and talking about this and saying in Berlin, you know, people can go and pay the equivalent of $20 because they can charge so much less. And here, you know, you've got the MCA now saying they might have to start charging people because funding levels are just costs of everything going up. So it really is challenging, and I suppose we're a sort of relatively small market too. So it's difficult.
Yeah.
And our funding levels are low, and you just getting the message through. I don't know. We never seem to get there, do we?
No.
There was a time when I think even David Williamson talking about this and saying it's sort of disappointing that we're having to argue the economic case for the arts and the stats all the time and point out that so much funding goes into mining. People forget that the government puts all this money into keeping mining companies going, and yet they complain, oh, you know, why are you putting money into the arts? That's elite. But we put so much money into sport too. Why is it suddenly elite to put it into the arts? But David Williamson saying, here we are, we're constantly having to talk about the economy of the arts, the stats, you know, when we should be talking just about how vital, you know, the arts are to any culture.
Mm-hmm. And the arts are not just opening night at the opera, at the Opera House.
No.
It's Netflix,
no.
It's streaming services, it's the radio. It's,
yes, exactly. Yeah. It's your book covers.
Yeah.
It's the arts surround us, and a lot of people probably don't even think of it as the arts. I mean, They watch television all the time. These are actors who are trained, like theatre actors.
Yeah.
It's been a hard one to fight the cause.
Well, at least we have Limelight to keep us informed and
entertained
and engaged.
We move on. I feel we are obviously a little niche publication, but we're still holding our subscription base, we're building our digital platform. So I feel that's pretty impressive in this climate, because it's very difficult for a niche publication to survive. We just need, as we always do, we would just love more people to subscribe. More people who absolutely love the arts and aren't aware of us.
Yeah. Well, I think that might be it. A lot of people may not be aware.
Yeah.
Because it is such a glossy, fabulous magazine.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm proud of it. Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm biased, but I'm really proud of it. But we're a tiny little unit, very small staff. We don't have big budgets. And I suppose if we had more money to do more marketing, that maybe more people would become aware of us.
Mm.
But you really, you can only read us now. The physical print, you have to subscribe. But the digital, you can go online and read all our reviews and news stories for free. They're free for 30 days.
Right.
So, you know, it's really worth... We cover such a lot. Every day we put up news stories, we put up reviews, we put up features. And all that stuff is, as I say, for a month you can read it free before it goes behind the paywall. The magazine is posted online as well, but it is behind the paywall.
So,
but we have to pay our writers.
Of course. So best to subscribe.
Yeah, subscribe, and it's not even expensive.
It's not.
No.
I've just taken out my 2-year subscription and... Yes.
Well done, and thank you.
And I get so excited when I open the mailbox and there's the latest Limelight. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so thank you. Continued strength to you, Jo Litson, and thank you for this delightful chat on Stages.
Oh, lovely. Thank you, Pete. Lovely to talk to you.
The Limelight magazine is such a vital publication, celebrating the arts across the nation. I love it. Subscriptions are worth investigating at limelight-arts.com.au. You'll certainly stay informed. Thank you to my featured guest in this episode, arts journalist Jo Litson. And thank you for joining us in this episode. It's always great to have your company.
I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.